Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, YouTube at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited, or bookmark our website at moviegeeksunited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited. United, as we're taping this show, we are mere hours away from the premiere of Phil Spector on HBO starring Al Pacino. And anyone that knows anything about me knows that the day that a new Pacino film gets released or aired, that it's like Christmas Day for me. So, actually, we're taping it before the premiere. The show will air after the premiere. So let me just go ahead and say it was fantastic. All right.
Yes.
So, what came out this weekend? The Croods?
Everyone who saw that said it was actually good. So, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a masterpiece. Who knows?
It did well. You know, those family movies do really well. And it didn't, as far as I know, it didn't really have very much advanced marketing and publicity surrounding it.
Yeah. I mean, you can't fault them. I mean, that's the kind of film going forward. If you can bring the whole family to it and it's in 3D, that's what's going to be number one that weekend. It doesn't matter what it is, but if you can take the whole family to it, then you've got it made. So we've been seeing that, and we're going to see more of it. So,
what about Spring Breakers? Is that like a take the whole family to kind of movie?
My niece wanted to see that, but she's 12, so... You know how we all thought this was going to be, well, at least I thought, oh, Harmony Korine's trying to go mainstream? Nothing could be farther from the truth. But it's a very well-made film. It is disjointed. It is, how should I say it, it's like watching a hallucination in action. It's messed up, but it's very well done.
Mm.
And James Franco's second great performance, you know, after Pineapple Express, I mean, this is it. He has to play a drug dealer. This is obviously the secret of his success. I have to play a drug dealer.
I saw a James Franco movie the other night. Actually, it isn't a James Franco movie, but it's a movie with him in it, like a little cameo part. The movie The Iceman.
Oh, okay.
You remember the HBO documentaries about the mob contract killer? Kuklinski was his name?
Yeah.
So anyway, and he killed like probably up to 200 people. But the thing that made him unique, and I guess this is a defining trait of a sociopath, is that, I mean, he was very sensitive and about his family and a very kind of loving, doting father and husband for the most part, and yet completely cold-blooded and about whacking people, about assassinating people. So that sense of duality was what made him interesting. Michael Shannon plays him in the movie. Originally, Mickey Rourke was going to play him, but I guess he dropped out. And Michael Shannon is this actor that's incredible. Like I said in the interview that we did with the director of it, he's incredibly intense, and there's always like this sense of mystery about Michael Shannon. like you don't quite get 100% full picture of Michael Shannon, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, who is he? You know, you don't really know completely. And that works well for this character. But once you get the sense of the dichotomy at work, the kind of the duality of him, the movie doesn't really have much else, much other reason to exist.
Right, okay.
You know? But it does have great performances. Ray Liotta's in it, and he's really good. David Schwimmer, like, plays a sleazebag in the movie, and he's pretty good. Chris Evans is, like, unrecognizable. Robert Davi is in it. So
that was an interview I really loved, by the way, our Robert Davi interview. I love that interview. That was a great interview.
Yeah, he was
one
a good guy.
New York.
Good guy.
He's a good guy. He's a good
Did
fella.
Did you see Olympus Has Fallen?
Yeah, we saw that on Thursday night. It's good, but you can't help but watch it. I noticed the reviews brought this up. Like, halfway through, you realize, you know, remember the whole Die Hard formula, you know, Die Hard on a bus, Die Hard. It's Die Hard in the White House, essentially. I mean,
yeah.
But I really want to like Gerard Butler, but he's just no Bruce Willis. And I think the first half hour of the movie is sensational. I don't, 9/11 really messed us up in that sense, because it's like, you know, with War of the Worlds or that, not the new Die Hard movie, but the one before that, the way things unfold is very much like in that the 9/11 narrative. It's just so messed up. It just like really catches you off guard and everything. I didn't know the North Koreans were this powerful. I had no idea.
Well, we have to have an enemy at least.
Yeah,
movies.
I mean, it's like this in the Red Dawn remake. I mean, oh my God, I really didn't know that. I mean, I bet Dennis Rodman's going to protest this film. That's all I can really say.
Yeah, probably. So what is it? Do they take the White House hostage, like the building itself?
They take that hostage. They really wreck DC. I mean, dude, I'm speaking of Die Hard. Like the second Die Hard, where just like so many people like got killed and everything. I haven't seen this many innocent people get gunned down before in a long time. I mean, I was just like, oh my God, these guys are relentless. Oh my God, it was crazy.
Well, if that's not a ringing endorsement, I don't know what is.
No, it has the advantage. We've had all these, you know, this has been I think everything's said and done, this is going to become, at least the first half of this year, a really bad year for action movies. You know, the Stallone, the Schwarzenegger, the Jason Statham, even if you want to throw in the Rock snitch for that matter, the action movie is really something that's stale. And then you have something like this, and this is all right. I mean, it's not great, but it'll be out in DVD, I guess, in 2 or 3 months. As I've noticed everything lately, the window gets smaller and smaller. So.
Probably so. Do you have higher hopes for the other White House movie, the Roland Emmerich, Jamie Foxx one?
Well, yeah, I mean, because Roland Emmerich loves to destroy the White House. It doesn't matter what movie it is. I mean, Independence Day, the day after tomorrow, 2012. I mean, he hates that building. He hates that building.
He should work for Washington, D.C. Demolition or something.
He really should. But it's not just that. It's interesting you say that because, you know, the G.I. Joe sequel that comes out next week deals with, you know, in one sense, the White House. They take over, you know, the United States government. And also in Iron Man 3, it looks like something to do with the president from that new trailer that they released. So it's just not a good year to be the president of the United States in movies, huh?
Hmm. Interesting.
But,
well, the problem is, too, is that, you know, anytime there's a wannabe action star that comes out now, or that's been this way for years, I mean, just like Gerard Butler in this movie, it's like, see the next Bruce Willis, or, you know, they always try to mold them after the model of someone else. And
right.
When Bruce Willis actually came out in Die Hard, we had no real model for that except for Harrison Ford, but that model didn't fit at all for Bruce Willis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they both had an everyman quality, but it was kind of a different, completely different set of circumstances.
Right.
You know, he wasn't an adventurer. He was a blue-collar working guy, you know.
Up until that time, Bruce Willis was considered a comedy star.
And a TV actor, really, more than anything else.
A TV
else.
Actor, yeah.
I mean, the idea of Bruce Willis opening a movie was, at that time, laughable.
Yeah, I'm just talking about how people tried to define or compare him to another action star when he hit it big in Die Hard.
Yeah. But
he was really the only kind, the only one of his kind at that time, really. And since then, everybody else has been compared to him when they try that.
Yeah. You know,
well,
so.
Speaking of Bruce Willis starting in TV and comedy and all that kind of stuff, the creator of Moonlighting, Glenn Gordon Caron, is going to be coming on the show soon, and we're going to talk about his first feature film, which was Clean and Sober, because it's coming up on 25 years.
That's a great
anniversary for that movie. So I'm sure he's anxious to talk about it. He probably never really gets to talk about it.
No, I mean, that's a great movie. I mean, and that's another, like, really one of that movie and the performances, and especially Keaton's performances, as we said before, is really one of the great, I think, underrated performances
of
the American
decade.
Cinema.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely.
So,
Dean, you went and saw a lot of stuff, I'm sure, as the closing of the 2013 Atlanta Film Festival. Let's hear about your film festival experience first from this weekend, and then I'll go into mine.
Okay. Well, the closing night movie last night was James Ponsoldt's The Spectacular Now. You know, he's just coming off of doing a film with a pretty good movie with Mary Elizabeth Winstead called Smashed. The Spectacular Now is a really, really beautiful, moving story of a small-town high school student in his senior year who loses, you know, breaks up with his girlfriend and then rebounds with a sort of wallflowery kind of girl played by Shailene Woodley. And the lead character in the film, I got to look up his name now, so excuse me. But
I got it right here. Is it Miles Teller?
Yeah, and he was in. I think his biggest role to this day has been he's the guy that accidentally kills the child of Nicole Kidman and Aaron Eckhart in.
Oh my God!
Rabbit Hole. This film is so sweet. It's such a wonderful little movie. You could compare it to something, very fairly compare it to something like Breaking Away or even Perks of a Wallflower. I think it's better than Perks of a Wallflower.
Okay.
I think it's a little bit more truthful. It's interesting, too. It seems to exist in sort of it was filmed in Athens, Georgia, and the book, the book story is set in Oklahoma, but James Ponsoldt, being a native of Athens, Georgia, wanted to return to Athens, Georgia, and just make that into Anytown USA kind of. He does a great job of actually also making the film feel sort of timeless. Well, I mean, it's just refreshing that there are no computers in it. There's very few computers and not a lot of phones and stuff like that. So, it's just a beautiful, beautiful little romance. It's Shailene Woodley is absolutely terrific in it. Miles Teller really feels like a kind of like a throwback to like the young Tom Hanks or maybe the young Patrick Dempsey or something like that. You know, it's got a nice supporting cast. Kyle Chandler has a really terrific supporting role that only lasts a few scenes, but he's superb in it. It's scheduled to be released in August, so it'll be a nice sort of break at that time for because I think we'll be actioned out by that moment and we'll have something really terrific.
We'll be devastated after that, so we could use it actually. And you said something about timeless, and the writer of obviously 500 Days of Summer. That's another one where computers are barely. There's no mention of MySpace or Facebook or anything like that in that movie. And I think that is. I think it's something. It might be just judging from what you said and looking at the other movies that he has in the pipeline. Those writers have in the pipeline the Fault in Our Stars, which is a very, very famous young adult novel and everything. That might be their MO, really. That might be their thing, is that we don't need to use what we can actually do this to make it so that 20 years from now, someone watching this won't feel like, oh, wow, you know, make it so dated, which is a problem.
Yes.
With, you mentioned, as much as I like Perks of Being a Wallflower, let's be very honest, it is, in the sense of the way they film it and the way it, and when it was written, it's dated. There's no way, there's no way around that. And it's
which
like,
is
and
ironic because it's supposedly a period piece, but yet it feels like it feels. I don't know. It's hard to explain about that movie, but I think it scuttles a period piece thing. You know, that,
mm-hmm.
that they want to set up, and somehow that does date the movie in some way. It's strange,
mm-hmm.
but it's true. Yeah, I mean, but this is just you know, I mean, it feels more real. It feels you know, the performances feel more real. They're a little less showy than they were in that film. It's not as syrupy sweet as that movie is, as Perks is. The other films that I've seen, you know, that the Spectacular Now was really terrific, but the best movie that I saw at the festival by far is a movie called A Teacher, and that's also going to be released in September in
mm-hmm.
New York and L.A., probably at IFC, as the director told me. It's directed by a newcomer named Heather Fidel, and it's set in Austin, Texas. It follows a high school English teacher played by Lindsay Burge, a newcomer who's really, really absolutely unbelievable in it. She's conducting an affair with one of her 17-year-old students, played by Will Bertain, who's also very, very good in the movie. The movie is basically, you know, a two-person movie, although there's a lot of supporting characters, but the camera is so trained in on these two people, particularly Lindsay Burge in the lead, that it almost feels like there's nobody else in these two people's worlds, really, at least at this point in their lives. You know how I like how I had such criticism for Argo being shot in what I thought was a lot of close-ups.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's a movie that does does its action almost totally in close-ups too. But here it actually works because this is such an intimate story, and there's so much pressure coming down on both of these characters, particularly the teacher, the lead character. There's so much pressure coming down. I mean, she's somebody who's closed off emotionally. She's estranged from her family. She's you get the sense that, you know, in high school she might not have been that popular, and so she's kind of catching up for lost time, and dating now, getting to date the popular high school kid that she wasn't able to date when she was in high school. And plus she obviously knows she's doing something wrong that could ruin her career. So the pressure there is just immense. And somehow something about the close-ups, the immense number of close-ups that Heather Fidel uses really transmits that kind of feeling of being crushed, you know? So we got to take a advanced look at a really terrific movie geeky kind of documentary called Casting By, and it's directed by Tom Donahue, and it really examines the history and of the casting director in movies, and it does so by focusing in on one of the most respected casting directors out there. Their name is Marion Daugherty. She passed away a few years ago, but the movie has extensive interviews with her, and she's really the pioneer in casting. Marion Daugherty is the one who really transformed the whole business. The film has interviews with Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Robert Duvall, Clint Eastwood, Jeff Bridges, Robert Redford, Woody Allen, Richard Dreyfuss, Diane Lane, John Travolta, John Voight, Ned Beatty, and most of those people have nothing but incredible things to say about Marion Daugherty. Their careers probably wouldn't exist without her because she brought a sense of actually looking at the interior life of the actor themselves. And not just looking, not just casting based on their looks like they did in the old days of Hollywood. Another
great documentary I saw was called The Great Chicken Wing Hunt, and it's by Matt Reynolds, and it's a movie about chicken wings, and Matt Reynolds is in the movie. It's not only just the director and the producer, but it's also in the movie. And it follows him as he abandons his career as a journalist overseas for Reuters and takes some of his Czech and Slovakian friends who he met in Eastern Europe back over to America to act as his compatriots and as crew for his making of this film, in which he gets together a busload of very eccentric chicken wing enthusiasts for a 3-week tour of what he calls the Wing Belt, which would be, you know, the northeast of the United States, you know, so around Buffalo, where the chicken wing was first invented by an Italian couple. And basically it follows them as they sample almost 100 different varieties of chicken wings over the course of those 3 weeks. And with the intent of finding the very best one. It's an incredibly emotional movie. It's surprising that it has so much emotion in it. You would think that it might be just sort of a foodie kind of film. It's just really beautiful. I think it's a real crowd pleaser. At 70 minutes, it's incredibly economical. It's very fast moving, and I think everybody who sees The Great Chicken Wing Hunt will love it. So search it out, and you won't be sorry. I did see one terrible movie. I saw a movie called Jay Upshaw by Bruce Mason. This was really horrible. It was it's a comedy out of L.A. It's got Ileana Douglas, who's very good in the movie. She's the one bright spot in the movie. And she's married to Kevin Pollak. And together they run a bed and breakfast that is currently going out of business. It's under immense immense pressure from the banks to close down. They finally come up with a solution to change their fortune by switching their bed and breakfast from just a simple bed and breakfast to a place that's aimed at helping sick people commit suicide. Let me just say, this movie is not funny. I can't say that I'm mad that I was offended by the movie. The biggest thing that I was offended by the movie was not that they were making jokes out of assisted suicide and all that kind of stuff. That's fine. That could be done right if it's in the right hands. But in this movie, you know, the two main characters are so incredibly dumb that it's just hard to get past how stupid their choices are. So avoid Chez Upshaw. That's Chez Upshaw at all costs. It's, unless you're a big Ileana Douglas fan, and why shouldn't you be? Finally, I want to take a look at two real short looks at two other documentaries that I saw. One is directed by Muta Ali Mohammed and is produced by Lef Ottolenghi, who is also the narrator of the film, and the film is called Submit. And it is about cyberbullying. And this movie was extraordinary in that I never really considered how difficult it is to actually combat cyberbullying. You can't go to the police for it. There are no laws on the books for it. In the movie, they talk to a lot of families who've been affected by cyberbullying to the point where, you know, the children who've been affected actually committed suicide. If you try and sue somebody, the likelihood is that the complications of the case will make it so that you won't get any kind of remuneration out of it, and you'll end up actually going in, the family will end up actually getting re-victimized again because they end up going in the hole to pay for lawyer bills. The movie Submit is very good. It's a little pedantic, but it's very, very good. Finally, I want to talk about The Institute, one of the most
one of the strangest films I've ever seen. Seriously. It's directed by Spencer McCall. It comes out of San Francisco, and it tells the story, a very, very complicated story of, okay, in San Francisco during 2008 through 2011, people used to go on the streets and see flyers up with a phone number to call for this institute called the Jejun Institute. And it'd be this very unusual flyer. And if you called the number, you were directed to this faceless office. And then when you got to the office, they told you to go someplace else. And it, basically what it ends up being is a very, very complex art treasure hunt that can go on for like a year if you go into it. And what's unusual about the movie is that the director, Spencer McCall, went out and shot some of the treasure hunt and shot interviews with people who had gone through it, but he also uses some of the very, very strange video that was provided by this institute. And so when you're watching the film, you can't tell if it's a mockumentary or if it's an actual documentary or not. And it takes really about halfway through the movie before you just have to say, okay, I guess it's real. I just don't know, you know. In fact, when the movie was over, I still didn't know it was real. It really took me to see the director up there talking about it to decide, okay, I guess it was real. It's definitely one of the very most unusual things I've ever seen in my life. Anyway, I saw a lot of great shorts and so forth, and I'll be covering that stuff on FilmicAbility, and I'll be giving full reviews of everything that I saw on FilmicAbility.blogspot.com, so you can check all the films out, even all the shorts and everything. I just want to say I met so many great filmmakers and saw, you know, I mean, 98% of everything that I saw was just terrific. So I have to send my thanks out to the Atlanta Film Festival and to its organizers and its staff and its guests for providing just a really terrific time. And I can't wait to go next year. So that's my
Rich
report.
Kenny has videotaped a lot of your stuff, and he's posting it on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited. You can check out some of that there. Some of that is already up there, and I would imagine there'll be couple more segments coming in the next couple of days.
Yes.
So out of all those, you would say that A Teacher would be the biggest recommendation?
A Teacher is going to be a movie that I'm going to be talking about, I guarantee you, when the wrap-up comes for 2013. I know that that's going to be that and The Spectacular Now. And maybe The Great Chicken Wing Hunt if it actually gets distribution in this time period.
Okay, cool. Cool, okay. I'll talk a little bit about Gasparilla Film Festival after our first guest segment tonight. William Fichtner, a great actor. He's in a great position, too, because as I talked to him in this interview, he can do the biggest budgeted Bruckheimer-esque movies, and then he has the freedom to go and do any kind of indie movie that he wants that really give him unique opportunities to play really different kinds of characters. I mean, the
Dark
Knight.
Yeah, I remember him in Go.
Yeah, Go and The Dark Knight and Black Hawk Down and Armageddon, and then he's playing the villain in The Lone Ranger, and then he goes and he does a movie like Wrong, which is the new movie that he's here to talk about that's on demand currently. Wrong. Talk about a unique, odd movie. This is from the writer-director of Rubber, the movie about the killer tire.
Yeah, I remember that. Oh, God. Okay.
It's written and directed by Quentin Dupuis, and it stars Mr. Fichtner and an assortment of other great actors. Mr. Fichtner plays Master Chang. Who knows where he comes from? He has this very unique accent. It's hard to pin down. But he's kind of like a dog whisperer in the movie.
Okay.
This is a movie that, you know, you could try to describe it, but it's better just to see it. So I would recommend you order it on demand now where it's available. But here's Mr. Fichtner to talk all about that film and some other highlights of his career.
Remember when my agent called me and he said, listen, I want to send you a movie. Now, I'm not sure what you're going to think about this. And I read it, I called him right back, and I said, absolutely, set it up. I've got to meet a guy that wrote this. That's Quentin. You know, that's who he is. To say that he's an original is, I don't know, it just sounds like too much of a cliche.
Well, obviously, this one and Rubber, they both have such a unique tone to them. Does that translate into the set? I mean, what is the environment he maintains on the set?
This isn't your typical set experience, because this is a very, fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants indie movie. It's not like, working on the Lone Ranger or something, where it's, the time in the world. You have no time in the world on a film like this. You know, I love that, and I appreciate that sort of filmmaking. But this was really driven, to get back to your original question, this is driven by director and his vision and a story that's is nonlinear, to say the least. You know what it is. You read the movie. You're like, wow, okay. And you listen to the director and have him take what he's giving, and you just try to find what is the moment that he's looking for. It's a pretty quick process. I think he shot this whole film in, 17 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell me what that does for you as an actor, because you're in such a terrific position where you do a great number of bigger studio movies, and then you have freedom to do the smaller independents. Is there at all any kind of benefit to working at a faster pace like you do on the indie films?
No, I don't think there is a benefit. I think they're all wonderful. A lot of it is preparation for yourself, too. Listen, if you go to work on an indie film, and you know that day I'm going to do that scene in Spark Like and Wrong, basically you're going to speak for about 2 pages. Odds are you're not going to do that on a big budget. On a smaller film, we're going to do that scene today, then we're going to do this other scene, then we're going to do this scene and this scene. On a smaller film, what your preparation is has to be ready for the day. Different on the bigger budget. It's just not gonna, they have the money to take the time. And oftentimes there's special effects involved. Well, that's a different experience. It's not easier. It's just, it's not harder. I don't find
right.
it. No, I just
right.
find that the spirit and the rhythm of something like this is, hey, you know what? Craft service isn't that whole truck over there. It's like, organic sandwiches being made right now. It's this table over here with M&M. It's okay. It's just different.
Well, I guess from an actor's standpoint, when I was talking about does it alter the process at all? I mean, does it allow for more spontaneity? Because you really don't have the luxury of time to second guess your choices.
Yeah, I still come back to the same thing where I think when in Rome. When you're shooting a film like Wrong, I don't think like, wow, it's going to be a different kind of day today, I know what kind of day it's going to be. I know what kind of movie we're shooting. I know what the budget is. But, be that as it may, it is what it is. What's more important is trying to find the guy, trying to find what the piece is, trying to capture the director's vision on something. All of that is no different, no matter what the movie is. Now, I have to tell you, it doesn't make a difference to me. When they hit the sticks and the actor says, and it's time to roll, I'm not really looking around thinking like it's, for a $50,000 budget or $200 million. I'm not really thinking. Once the sticks hit, all I'm thinking about is trying to find the guy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Fully realize it.
Now, tell me about finding the guy, because Master Chang is such a unique creation. Did it feel like you kind of had no boundaries to work within when you were building this character?
Well, listen, first of all, right off the bat, his name is Master Chang and he's a white guy. So already we got some space. You know what I mean? We got a little room to go here. Self-made multimillionaire that's like this dog guru. And see, to me, it's you know, listen, I don't want to get into too much after sort of like about, you know, what my process was or something. Jeez, I'll fall asleep talking about it. But I did know, you know, kind of getting back to your question, do you feel like you had, like, you know, so much room to go play with this? Well, I think it's kind of built in that there's a lot of room. He's a dog guru. His name is Master Chang. He takes people's animals so they can appreciate what it's like not to have them. Then he loses one of them. You know, listen, we've all met some spiritual people, you know, some great, lovely, you're around them. It's just so great. And we've all met some, one or two in our lifetime that, like, you know, they went to another place, you know, a preciousness that's just a little bit odd. I feel like Master Chang kind of went that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of became a little bit bigger than the enlightenment of it all. In there, like I say, I rarely talk about, like, the inner workings of characters. But
mm-hmm.
somewhere in there lies an awful lot of room to interpret.
You are fantastic in one of my all-time favorite movies. It's a movie that means so much to me, and that's Heat. And, you know, speaking of unique directors, I mean, Michael Mann definitely falls in that category, but tell me about his kind of meticulous nature of directing and what that gives you as an actor.
Michael's meticulous?
That's what I've come to understand.
Yeah, I remember the first night that we were shooting Heat, and first 2 days of principal photography were pretty much the office building where Van Zandt was. It's the first day of shooting. It must have been 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and we were on take 7. Yes, Michael Mann, if I said something I should try, and he said, no, you keep trying it, that I would, it's up there. I would find it. Or maybe I already did it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is he meticulous? Yeah, I gathered that. Yeah. He wanted things a certain way, for sure. We were very specific about wardrobe, very specific about the rehearsal. But you know what? Through it all, I have to tell you, above all, I loved being around him.
Mm.
Loved being on set with him.
And finally, we had a lot of listeners, before I let you go, a lot of listeners asking about Prison Break. And I kind of want to know about that experience in this aspect of the experience. When you're working on a TV series like that, I would think that you form a bond with your company that's pretty strong, I mean, for an extended period of time. Do you mourn at all when that ends and you leave that family?
I embrace change. And when something finishes, you know, listen, I have friends that I'm very close to that, like, you know, they really kind of mourn it, like, wow, man, kind of withdraw from the whole thing. I'm never that guy. I love the plane ride home. I love thinking about what I just did and hopefully that it's good, that I did well in it, and I look forward to the next thing. Prison Break was one of those very unique things where we shot it in Dallas and I came to home. Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, there's still a couple of guys I keep in touch with from it. And that's cool. You know, our producer on it, Gary Brown, I still keep in touch with him. We have the same birthday. We'll always wish each other a happy birthday on that day. It's a time in your life, and that's the way I look at everything. You look at the wall in your room, and it's, if you broke it up into pieces, everything that you do is a piece of the puzzle that makes up who you are. And Prison Break was a big piece, But when I walked away at the end of the day, am I proud of it? Did I feel good about it? Did I do what I hopefully wanted to do with the guy? Yeah. So, yeah, I walked away with a good feeling about my time on Prison Break.
Yeah.
But I worked.
Well, sir, thank you so much. I love your work very much, and I appreciate the time very much today.
My pleasure. You take care of yourself.
Okay, that was William Fichtner. The movie is called Wrong. And it really can't be wrong if it feels so right. So order it right now on video on demand. Our last guest tonight is Eric Walter. He has a new documentary that's available now on demand. We talked about it a little bit last week. It's called My Amityville Horror, and it tells all about the story of a young boy who was 10 years old at the time that his family moved into the infamous Amityville house, mere months after the murders took place in that house. And the family quickly moved out 28 days later because they were befuddled by paranormal activity. And this is the first time this gentleman, who is now obviously a grown man, has come forward and told his story. It's a fascinating movie. It's available on demand, like I said. Here is the writer, director, producer, editor, and production manager of that film, Mr. Eric Walter.
You know, one of my therapists not too long ago asked me if I could, in less than a sentence, describe what or label these experiences. And all I can come up with, and the first thing that I came up with, and I haven't been able to find anything better than that, is that this is an unfortunate gift in my life. I started telling you, you know, this is not something I asked for or achieved or earned or anything like that. So when this was... when I'm going through experiences that I am now going to go to the priest at church and he's looking at me like, boy, what is wrong with you? You know, I knew my life was turning into something that I had no control over. And I became out of control. It's not easy to tell somebody how you got thrown up a staircase. It's not easy to tell somebody that your bed was bouncing off the ceilings because the headboard posts are jammed into the sheetrock. We got stench, and we got black toilets, and we got thousands of flies. This is just like, it's like a fucking carnival, man. I'm getting a little tight right now. This is not something I enjoy discussing. I don't look forward to this shit. Because once I start talking about it, even just to bring you back to a moment, for a moment, I become stuck with it.
And now that the film is completed and you can look back on it, as a filmmaker, do you feel as though you have accomplished what you set out to do?
Well, you know, my job as a documentarian, obviously, is to collect all the information that I possibly can from all the sources. And unfortunately, I would say that, of course, I would like to solve the mystery of the Amityville Horror. However, I think that's almost an impossible or unconscionable scenario in many ways. Of course, I would have loved to have gotten more from Danny. However, we were lucky to have gotten what we did with him because of how a contentious issue and also how of a heated individual he can be at times. I would have loved to have interviewed the other siblings and other members of the Lutz family. However, they are choosing to remain, you know, private this time. Hopefully, by Danny moving forward and talking, you know, someday they'll be willing to speak on a more feature-length level, as Danny did for this. So, no, I mean, of course, as a filmmaker, you're always wanting there to be more and more insight on things. But I think the film represents the fuzzy line between reality and imagination, and I'm actually very pleased with its current form and to have touched on a subject that really, or look at an aspect of a subject that had never really been looked at before.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of Daniel Lutz, you mentioned how he's a very intense guy, and I've read in previous interviews how you mentioned how he would scare members of the crew sometimes because he was so intense. As a filmmaker, how do you sort of rein that in to make it, I guess, coherent and in the context of the film to where it's not just him going off on tangents?
Right. Well, I mean, how do we control him, basically?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
That's it, right, right. Well, I mean, it's a difficult process because when you're doing what we did, which was the kind of a cinematic process of presenting the material, not your typical run-and-gun documentary format, obviously there was a lot of questions Danny had about going forward with it and how we were going to do that. And obviously I had questions about how he was going to react on camera. So it was a process of keeping even down, you know, stripping the set down, having a closed set and various scenarios such as, you know, when he's meeting with a therapist and when he's talking with different people like Lorraine Warren and Laura DiDio who were, you know, worked on the original case. It was a, you know, process of making him the most comfortable in that situation. And obviously also me having to befriend him and gaining his trust and wanting to speak publicly on something that, you know, he's essentially suppressed for over 35 years now. So it wasn't an easy process, and there was a lot of groundwork, which, you know, most documentaries are that way. You know, I've been working on this nearly 5 years now on this project alone, but I had quite a bit of knowledge of the story leading into that. So I think it was that combination of having, you know, a well-rounded opinion and knowledge on the story that Danny felt comfortable that he didn't have to educate me on the story. And that was kind of why I was essentially chosen by him to be the vessel for him to tell his story. However, I think at times I've always, you know, in post-production, I made choices to, you know, involve other, you know, objective viewpoints that give it a well-rounded look at something, which I think, you know, makes him uncomfortable. And in certain aspects, I would say, you know, the idea of repressed memories and how his memory could have been skewed by the media in one way or another, how his memory of it may not represent the actual truth. And that, again, like I mentioned, that fuzzy line between reality and imagination. So with all those things, having to kind of, you know, keep him on a, be open with him, but also ask, you know, hard questions.
After you were done shooting certain interviews with him, did you find that for you personally, it was sort of a hard, feeling to shake or hard to shake what you were kind of listening to and experiencing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, I mean, for him, this is all very real. And it was not something that I feel that was a hoax for him. I mean, there's been so many stories about this over the years that this was, you know, all a sham and it was all done for the money by the Lutz family. And I've never felt that to be, you know, an out-and-out truth. I think that many things, obviously, have been said about it that are not true. Even, you know, there are a lot of inconsistent statements from the Lutzes themselves. However, I think that a lot of this has to do more with the media's misconstruing of the story than it does anything that the Lutzes have done to themselves. So with Danny, it's been kind of a process of, you know, weeding through all that information, and it's been a difficult, I mean, certainly he believes that something of a paranormal nature happened in the house, but it's differentiating, you know, your memory of the event with the memory of obviously his anger towards the stepfather, George, who was kind of the main voice of this story for so long. And one of the things that he constantly was saying during the production that's in the film is that his biggest regret was not speaking out before now and not speaking out as a kid, that the story has now become, you know, so mired in misinformation that it's hard to kind of remove it from that. So I think that the film now represents, you know, someone living in the shadow of something that they never really asked for. Essentially, he's been indoctrinated into it. And but, yeah, he definitely believes that, that this all was very real. So the trauma was very real for him, and I don't think anyone can deny, even though there is a theatricality to his character, and he certainly, at many times, it appears playing towards, you know, to the camera, for the interviewers, for the people he knows who are listening to him. I still think that knowing him, that's the person that he is in real life, too. I mean, I've, in any situation, that's how he's acting. So it's, and I've spent it's been years now with him, so.
And he mentions how he has some regret for not doing this sooner. Why do you think he agreed to do this now?
Basically, he mentioned to me that the primary reason was because his children have reached an age, he has two kids, who've reached an age, you know, he's now divorced, but his two kids, he's never really given them an answer to who he is and what his past is about, and they've always asked him questions, and Dan had felt that he wanted to go and do this in a public venue, and I initially was very skeptical of that, honestly, when I was first contacted. Of course, I ran a website, kind of a web archive of all the documentation and newspaper archives and things on the DeFeo trial and the Lutz haunting online called Amityvillefiles.com. And he contacted me through that site because, you know, it was kind of an unbiased presentation of all those things I mentioned. And, yeah, I think that his anger towards the stepfather and that whole situation is where, you know, wanting to kind of set the record straight for himself and using and talking to someone that he felt would be, you know, an objective ear to listen to him. And at times it's been, I mean, obviously it's even been contentious between he and I. You know, he calls me out even during the shooting of the film and becomes almost irate with me at the end of the film when I ask him about taking a polygraph test, which in my opinion is a very logical question. I've seen a lot of people online that he denies taking the polygraph test. In fact, if you listen back, he says, yes, I would, but he is irate with me essentially because he took it as an assault on his credibility. He took, you know, he had just finished an 8-hour interview essentially talking about Amityville, which was something he didn't, was, you know, immediately clams up when you start talking to him about it and you have to kind of pry him open essentially to get all this information to come out. But that's where I think the anger was derived from for that. So it was kind of a process of showing all, you know, all the varying aspects of his character, and I think we were able to accomplish that with everything that I was possibly, you know, granted to do. And not that I was really not granted to do anything, it was just getting Danny to participate in everything I wanted to do. it was a difficult process, as one can imagine watching the film.
Oh, most definitely. And I wanted to ask you, for him personally, do you find that this process for him has been therapeutic, and has it helped him move on at all, would you say?
Sure. I mean, it absolutely. I mean, that was the overwhelming sense, I would say, from you know, day one I met him. I felt like this was almost a cathartic process. In a lot of ways, when I first went there, I took a digital recorder and about a set of 100 photographs from the night of March 6, 1976, when the house was investigated after the leftists fled and left all of their belongings. There were a lot of, you know, pictures that are actually in the film of the way the house was left with Danny's toys and, you know, his furniture, his bed, his bedroom, and, you know, all this. And he hadn't seen some of these photographs before. And so him flipping through this, you know, set of photographs and looking at this, you could just feel the years coming off his chest. You know, there was an emotional reaction to it. And obviously, as a filmmaker, when you see emotion, you know, boiling over in someone, you know that that person is ripe for essentially for a documentary first-person perspective. At the time, we were not talking about making a film. He wanted to talk about this in more of a book format, but I don't think anybody could deny Dan's power in his storytelling and also in what his, you know, he's just a provocative character. He could be talking about anything, and the guy would be interesting. So in those ways, I felt that it was definitely, like I mentioned, you know, right for a first-person account. And that's why I chose to shoot the film in the first-person perspective, like he's looking directly into the camera having a conversation with you, because, you know, you don't often see, I mean, some, of course, there's been a lot of Aaron Morris's work has been conducted that way, more of an interrogation type of sense, but I felt I really wanted to put people in, you know, my shoes when I had first talked to him, and, you know, he's sitting across the table, chain-smoking, you know, looking over these photographs, and chain smoking cigarettes, and just he's just a rough dude, and really, really very angry. And I think that sometimes reality is much more frightening than anything you can make up. And that was the picture that I thought that's what I wanted to show for people. And again, the emotional reaction to all of this that we were talking about—that was the real Amityville horror for me. And I'm very pleased to have shown that for people. However, it is a very tragic and sad picture. So I really wanted to do it with an ounce of respect. No matter what you believe about this story, whether it was a hoax or whether it was true, Danny definitely, most assuredly believes that it was true. And at the end of the day, that's what matters, because this person's life has been shaped and molded by something, essentially defined by this topic. And that's a horror unto itself.
Oh, for sure. And a final question for you is, you mentioned how Hugger in the end, he was getting a little contentious with you. So I want to ask you, in terms of the film now, as a finished product, how does he feel about the film? What were some things he liked about it and maybe didn't like about it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really careful when I talk about, I don't want to speak for Danny, obviously. At some point, I hope that he does come out and speak publicly to the media. However, the day the film released, last Friday, the 15th, he called me and thanked me for helping him and congratulated me. So I don't know, pull what you will from that. He was, you know, we've had a cordial relationship and we still do going forward. Obviously, it has had its heated moments when I've made choices in post-production about inserting various viewpoints of people that he thinks, you know, are full of, you know, BS. But at the same time, those people think he's full of BS. So it's a, you know, it's that you can't get away from that in the Amityville topic. But as a documentarian, you know, this is a very small fragment of a very large picture. This is a encapsulated viewpoint from the oldest kid who was in the house at the time. And he's the first of the children to speak out with his entire story, his entire account at that time. And, you know, I really wanted to, at times I wanted to bring people in to talk about the hoax aspects. And we did, of course, I asked many questions about that. But you almost in a lot of ways, Danny, there's a 10-year-old boy that's still there. And, you know, who's really harmed by this. And I felt like, you know, through getting to know him, it's not something that those questions he doesn't relate to. Of course, he says it's not a hoax, he says it's a film. But he doesn't... It's that emotional reaction he had. You can tell he's completely sold on that this actually happened. So whether it was, as the film suggests, through physical or mental abuse by the stepfather, or whether it was an out-and-out, you know, a possession, as Danny claims, I really think that both of those things, the trauma with the stepfather, the heated debate with the stepfather, and the haunting, were kind of intermixed for him. And that's fascinating unto itself, because I mentioned George Lutz was the main focal, you know, this voice in the story for so many years, and to hear this kind of flip side of, you know, something like this is, you know, extraordinary and very interesting, and it's definitely a new perception on something that's become a piece of American folklore.
Okay, that was Eric Walter, and thank you so much to Tony Farinella, who is our guest interviewer on that interview. Eric's film, My Amityville Horror, is available now on demand. Okay, so I attended the Gasparilla Film Festival like the past few days because, as I announced previously on the show, I was the member of the grand jury, so I voted for the best film for the festival.
Oh, cool.
So I went to the award ceremony earlier today, and it was particularly special because, I mean, what I chose won, I mean, because I was the one that was voting for them. But, so, you know, it was great to see the best film that I thought was the best film pick up that award. And then I said, you should single out two people. You should single out this actress from a movie called Philly Brown. Her name's Gina Rodriguez. So she got a special award. And then I said, you should single out the writer-director of this film called Against the Grain. And so he got the special award. So that was fulfilling. Philly Brown actually was the best movie at the festival. It's kind of like a hustle and flow from a female perspective.
Okay.
And a sensational lead performance by Gina Rodriguez, who's been on our show previously. She did a movie a couple of years ago that Carmen Morone directed called Go For It. She was on the show for that years ago. But the thing that really sold it for me finally was the closing scene of the movie. You truly see how her music, she's like a amateur hip-hop artist, that her way out of, you know, poverty and helping her family and is to break into the music business. But it's not done stereotypically. I mean, it's not done like these are the perils of the music business and the thing that you've seen 1,000 times before. It has elements that are very familiar. What really makes it pop are the performances. I mean, Edward James Olmos is in it, Lou Diamond Phillips, and Gina. And Gina's great, but she has one scene at the end where you really do feel where her art and her music comes from. And that's always the hardest thing when you do something about an artist, a film about an artist, to get to where that originates, what makes it the art, you know, what makes it personal. So I thought that was a very special scene towards the end of that movie. Philly Brown releases middle of April, and another great movie I saw was Kilimanjaro, which isn't it has a great cast. It isn't like a movie where there are seismic dramatic happenings. It's just kind of incremental things that happen in the movie Kilimanjaro, where a man just comes to a point in his life where he's finally able to assert himself. And that happens in very small steps. So I can see where some people might see that movie and think, nothing's happening in this movie. But actually the world is happening in this movie because he's finally becoming his own person, this lead character. And it's funny, and it's got great performances, and it's intimate. It's Abigail Spencer's in it, and a really good cast. What's the Brian Garrity? I think Brian Garrity's in it.
Cool.
And he's the lead in it. And he was in movies like Flight. He was in the movie Flight with Denzel Washington. He was the co-pilot.
He's great in that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I
know, he is.
Yeah. So anyway, those were the two big standouts. And Against the Grain is a really good first film about an inner city kid that goes to college and tries to stay on the straight and narrow and make his family proud. And you know, I had a couple of problems with that movie, but I thought that the tone of it was so compassionate and sensitive that I said we should give that writer-director a special award. So I was happy that was able to happen. So thank you to Gasparilla Film Festival for letting me be part of the grand jury. It was a nice experience, and, you know, my friend Rick, they have the showcase of student films, so they showed, like, maybe 10 or so student films Saturday morning. He had 5 of the movies in those 10 that he made with his students, and he won both awards. He won the Best Film Award and Best Audience Award, so he's just an exceptional talent Rick is, so he really does well with his students. So congratulations to him. I was sitting right next to him so I could support him. Ryan O'Nan, the actor that was in Brooklyn Brothers Beat the Best that I like so much, the one that starred in it and wrote and directed it, he was there, and he did a reading of a new script that he worked on about a gay werewolf, which was very funny. Thomas Jane was there, and he walks around barefoot everywhere. Like, he's walking around the restaurants and everything barefoot. He doesn't wear shoes. That's his thing. He doesn't wear shoes.
Okay.
That is weird. That's so strange. What about the new no shirt, no shoes, no service policy?
Apparently it doesn't apply to celebrities. I don't know. Colin Farrell showed up at the festival.
Oh
wow.
He was supporting a friend that had a short film there. And then Danielle Harris was there. She's tiny, Danielle Harris, man. She's just like one of the tiniest things I've ever seen. I'll break her in half.
Oh, my God, okay.
She's very pretty. I gladly would. But anyway, that's Gasparilla. Hey, big movie news from this past week, a big debacle with a movie called Jane Got a Gun.
Oh, I know. I mean...
Oh, boy. What a story this is.
Which was supposed to be the next film from Lynn Ramsey, her follow-up to We Need to Talk About Kevin that we all love so much. But the day of shooting, the first day of shooting, she leaves the production. She quits.
Oh,
did she just literally just not show? You know, the way that the media is portraying it, quite meanly, I think, is that she just didn't show up. Is that really the way that it happened?
Whether that's what she did or not, the result is the same. She quit.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she could have shown up and told people, and she probably did. She probably told her crew and her actors that she was quitting. But, I mean, you know, she's gone from the movie. But Ever Resourceful, the producer of the movie, actually got another director, Gavin O'Connor, who did Warrior, mm-hmm. had another director set up by the next morning. You know, he was ready for this.
He probably was.
And I think the rumor is that, you know, they didn't give her a budget, they didn't give her a schedule. Her lead actor that she wanted quit the movie before that, Michael Fassbender.
Oh, wow.
And they replaced him with an actor that came from Warrior, Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
The one that starred opposite Thomas Hardy in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Jude Law, after Lynn Ramsey left, and they replaced her with another director, Jude Law left. And he was, I think, the villain in the movie.
Right, right. Yeah, so, oh, my God. Okay.
Now he's gone, and so they got to scramble again to find a replacement for him. This is a movie that stars Natalie Portman.
It's a Western, right?
Yeah.
It tells the story of a frontier woman who reaches out to an ex-lover to help her defend her farm from her outlaw husband and his gang.
Mm. I'm still into watching it because I'll watch any Western that comes out, really.
Right, right. It sounds interesting, so.
I wonder what the real story is, though, behind her leaving.
I'm sure it'll come out.
We'll be hearing some.
When you quit a movie, I mean, she's had problems all the way through her career. She had problems with We Need to Talk About Kevin, with the financing of that, and
mm-hmm.
she was supposed to direct The Lovely Bones, and then she dropped out of that, and Peter Jackson took over. But the cancellation, or her quitting, I mean, canceled that week of filming, and now beyond that, with Jude Law quitting, it cancels even more time. You know, they had like 175 extras that had been hired and were working, and then all of a sudden they have nothing to do and they have to be sent home. And I mean, it's a big deal, and I'm sure they're eating money every single day because of this
mm-hmm.
thing. Tens of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. But I just don't want to see her get blackballed. I have a feeling that it might happen, though, but...
Yeah, I mean, if you screw with the finances, you probably will be blackballed.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean...
Yeah, that's just sad. That's just sad.
Anyway, what else is going on, guys?
Well, what about the Sorcerer news? The big news on Sorcerer.
Oh, yeah. That's huge. I mean, it looks like that's finally going to get a release on Blu-ray. I mean, it looks like the whole notion that, you know, William Friedkin was suing each one of the companies. What was it, 20th Century Fox and Warner Brothers?
I think
that's who it was. To try and figure out who had the rights to it, and that's been settled amicably, obviously, and so I guess William Friedkin is busy at work, you know, kind of restoring the film, you know, it's set for release on Blu-ray, not, you know, sometime within this year. So, I mean,
I don't know why that's news this week. Because he announced that like a couple of months ago. He said it's been settled,
right.
And we're remastering it now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know why that came. Yeah, I guess you're right, but I mean, I don't know. It just hit the people. Maybe it just got a release date or something like that. Maybe that.
No, I tried to watch it on the DVD, and because I special ordered a DVD of it, tried to watch it, and I thought it's just the quality's too poor. I want to appreciate this movie and with some clarity, you know. So I'm just, I took it back, and then I'm waiting for the remastered.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
I want to watch it, Sorcerer all fuzzy. I mean, this is this big epic. And it's raining all the way through the damn movie. It makes it look even fuzzier.
It's true. I just cannot wait to see that movie again. I just adore it so much.
Harry Reams.
What?
Do we know who Harry Reams is?
Yeah, we do. Deep Throat, so.
Yeah. First actor prosecuted, probably the only actor in the U.S. prosecuted for merely starring in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
He died. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't follow acting. I think he went to, he did some bit parts in movies over the years, but he went into real estate.
Right.
He got off drugs and drink, and he became a successful real estate broker. started a different life,
mm-hmm.
And did really well for himself.
Right, right.
And yet, you know, he always had this albatross around his neck of being part of the most famous porno film of all time, and mm-hmm. being spending time for it. And actually, at the time that he was prosecuted, a lot of people came to his defense. I mean, people like Nicholson and Warren Beatty and a lot of Hollywood heavy hitters, because they thought, you know, where does this end?
Right.
You know, once you set this precedent, you know, because they say that my movie is offensive, so let's take me to court over being in it, you know. So, I mean, an important figure in film, not to be dismissed.
Yes.
True.
And see that documentary I talked about the other week, Inside Deep Throat, if our listeners out there haven't. Because interesting story and fascinating characters behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and fascinating characters that we're going to see a lot more of, because we've got, what, like two movies about Linda Lovelace?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, we're going to, you know, that's coming, so no pun intended, but yeah, that is
yeah,
that's great, dude. That's a, you made it funny. That was good.
Yeah.
Mike Lee has a dream project, Dean, which I'm sure you know about.
Yes, I'm so excited about that.
About one of the great British painters, J.M.W. Turner, and Sony Pictures Classics has decided to finance it. They did another year for Mike Lee in 2010.
At the film festival where I saw that, you know, a couple of years ago, he said that he was struggling to get financing for it because it was obviously going to be a very expensive project, and even more expensive than, say, Topsy Turvy was, because it's going to require a lot of location work, a lot of very unusual. I mean, he's got, you know, there's. Turner was a very eccentric painter, and in order, just to give you an example, in order to get the best vantage point, he actually strapped himself to the head of a boat to get the best look at a raging sea and paint it. So he actually painted while strapped to the head of a boat. So this is something that you're going to, you know, that's obviously going to be dramatized. And if it's dramatized, you can see where this, even just this one scene would be incredibly, incredibly expensive to mount. So it's definitely going to be something different. It's Timothy Spall, but you know, it's going to be working with a lot of cast members, actors that he's familiar with. And, of course, the lead in the movie is a Mike Lee veteran. It's Timothy Spall. They haven't worked together for almost a decade now. I think the last movie they did together was All or Nothing. But before that, you know, he had been in Life is Sweet and Topsy Turvy. So and Secret and Lies as well. So it'll be a nice reunion there. And it's gonna be exciting. I'm glad that it's ready to go.
Yeah. Well, on the other end of the spectrum, Joel Silver is financing, producing Escape from New York remake as a trilogy.
As a trilogy. So does this mean it's going to go to L.A. and to another city, does that mean the whole thing's they're just going to expand the first? New York.
What would be the other? What would be a third? What would be a third city?
That's
know.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there you go. I mean,
what, does he hook up with RoboCop or something in the third one?
I would
That'd
say
be
cool.
So.
There was a RoboCop cameo in it.
Who would be cast as the new Snake Plissken?
Well, they were thinking a couple of years ago Gerard Butler, but I don't see that happening now. Mm.
No, that wouldn't be any fun. Three movies? I don't get the whole Gerard Butler thing. I don't know. Thomas Jane? No, I'm kidding.
Let's think about it. Do you think they go with Jason Statham? No. I mean, he's good, but I just don't see that happening.
I don't want to see a bald Snake Plissken. Snake Plissken's got to have some hair and stuff, you know.
Tom Hardy, then. That mullet. I mean, Tom Hardy will get it then.
You know what, though? Tom Hardy might be the good choice. Actually,
yeah.
out of everyone that we're dealing with now from that generation.
But would he play Matt? He's going to play Mad Max, but do you think, wait, I mean, if they offered him enough money, I'm sure
if
he's
Mad
good.
Max just goes through the roof, but Tom Hardy will be the first person that they go to for the Escape from New York remake. But, you know, but they can also go with another actor that isn't known for action roles. I mean, because Kurt Russell wasn't necessarily an action star at that point.
I mean, really
he was a Disney star at that point. Yeah. He played Elvis for John Carpenter, but previous to that. Was that previous to that, or was that the first movie they did together?
That was I think that was in 79. So I think that was the first movie they did together.
Yeah. And you wouldn't automatically think, let's get the guy that played Elvis Presley to play our apocalyptic warrior.
I hope that they just go and surprise us and don't do something that's predictable. Man, it'd be so much better if they just if they go for something that's surprising, somebody that's surprising.
As long as they keep Yaphet Kotto and Adrian Barbeau, I'm happy.
Not Yaphet Kotto. That was Isaac Hayes, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was Isaac Hayes.
Oh,
yeah.
God. I always get them confused.
Okay, that's fine.
We need more Yaphet Kotto in movies, though, don't we?
I agree. I think we need more Yaphet Kotto.
I think we're going to produce bumper stickers that say that, actually. That's going to be the next big Movie Geeks United movement. We're going to get our millions of listeners across the world. We're going to send them bumper stickers. It'll be bigger than Two Girls, One Cup.
Oh, come God. On. Okay, there you go, guys.
Oh, man. Or Yaphet
Kotto. Stoker. Jerry, you saw Stoker. Now, the main impression I get of this movie, and preface your review of it with this, is that this movie is more than a little indebted to De Palma.
I mean, there's that, but visually I kept thinking of Blue Velvet through parts of it, just because visually, I mean, not like story-wise or anything, but just visually, I mean, visually it's a breathtaking movie, but I mean, yeah, there was a lot to De Palma. It's so messed up. I mean, this is a family of fuck-ups. Oh my God! But it's good. It's not great. But it also has one huge problem. And as much as I love the director, he's like trying too hard to show off. Look what I can do. Look how you know flashy I am. He's like really showing off. And after a while, you're just like, stop. Just tell the story. You know? I mean, but it's a very he shows off a lot. It's interesting, but it's a messed up movie. You keep waiting for a hammer fight to break out. You're just, come on, can we have a hammer fight, please?
Like the rapper?
No, like an old boy, the great hammer corridor fight
hammer.
Sequence.
Okay.
I mean, just keep waiting for that.
Because that would be really wacky if MC Hammer showed up.
Oh, that would be. I mean, it's an interesting, I think, you know, definitely go check it out. But it's an interesting choice for your English language debut, definitely.
Interesting. I can't wait to see it. I mean, they're really opening it slow.
Yeah, they are. But
I don't even think it's here yet. Yeah.
It's worthwhile checking out, that's for sure. I mean, but it's a messed up movie.
Okay, let's go to our list for tonight. Next week we'll do a list of the top 10 movie romances. But I just happen to think we need to do a list in honor of Phil Spector's premiere tonight. So this is a list from Top 10 Films, FILMZ.com, of the top 10 Al Pacino performances. Always interesting to me to see, you know, somebody that knows his work so intimately, like I do, to see what other people consider his best. Number 10. Jack Kevorkian and You Don't Know Jack.
Okay.
Sure.
I would say yes. That's definitely one of his tops.
Pretty solid.
And for all those
work.
Pacino haters out there, that was only 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like he hasn't done great work in the past 20 years or so. Number nine, this is interesting. Steve Burns in Cruising. This is what they have to say about it. In this rarely discussed gem, Pacino plays Steve Burns, an undercover police officer who's tasked with infiltrating the underground gay scene in order to find the killer. It's a film that sparked controversy because of its themes, but also singled out Pacino as a daring performer, considering audiences had just seen him as Corleone and Frank Serpico, two powerful heterosexual characters. This was something entirely different. This is likely to be one of the least seen films in Pacino's catalog. Actually, I mean, I don't think it's one of his best performances. I think he's kind of interesting in it. What's interesting about Pacino in the movie is that you can tell he's completely uncomfortable being in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great assist for the actual character, as it turns out. But, you know, when they say the more daring of those performances is Dog Day Afternoon, where he played a homosexual character right after Corleone and Serpico.
Right
in between that area. And he was like one of the first mainstream actors to do that in Dog Day. Number eight, Lefty in Donnie Brasco. 100%.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
For sure. That would be in my top five.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be too. Well, and my number one is what this guy chooses for his number seven, which is what I just mentioned, Sonny in Dog Day Afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
It would be difficult to find a better performance for me personally, from anyone, than in Dog Day Afternoon, Pacino in that movie.
No doubt.
When you talk about actors living in the moment and being completely lost in that character, I think of Dog Day Afternoon. He doesn't wear a disguise. He doesn't put on a false voice, but after a while, you do not see Pacino in that movie necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
You're following Sonny, and that also speaks to Sidney Lumet. But
I think he has he's tweaking his voice just a little bit in that movie, just a little bit more Brooklyn than any other film.
Yeah,
but
my point is he's not trying on some exotic accent or anything. You know, it's about being naked in that movie and not putting on a disguise.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it's just one of his most physical performances. It's one of his most just exhaustive performances. He's, you know, just that. You know, I think back on just that one scene where he's sitting down, you know, talking on the phone to Leon, his lover, and saying goodbye to him and everything, and then having to call his wife and everything, and his actual, you know, female wife.
Right.
And just how exhausting those two scenes are back to back, you know, and you can just. You can just feel, the scene is just ridiculously electric. The whole movie is, and that would be my number one choice, too, as well.
Yeah, me too. Their number six is Frank Slade in Scent of a Woman, which is controversial. You know, I think it's controversial because this is the one he won an Oscar for. He didn't win for any of the others that he was so deserving of. It was Scent of a Woman, which a lot of people were dismissive of. But, you know, talk about indelible character. How indelible is his performance in this movie? It took him a while to shake it. I mean, you see elements of Frank Slade in a lot of his movies that followed. That's how indelible the role was, you know?
Not a performance, though, that I love or anything, or a movie that I've even gone back and reassessed or anything. It's just, I don't know, he's fine in it, yeah. But I would go some other place. I would leave room for another performance on this list.
Mm, okay.
Their number five is Frank Serpico.
Yes.
I mean, you got to put that in there. I mean,
in a way, that might be his most iconic performance in some ways. You know, I mean, just, you know, when you just think back on that poster with that picture of him, it's not, you know. And then I always think of, you know, John Travolta as Tony Manero, like with a Serpico poster in his room as he's being ready to go out to the disco.
Mm-hmm.
I think, oh my God, you know, what a what a character, what a performance.
Actually, out of all the real-life people that he's played, I think Serpico is the only one that he met and spent time with prior to shooting.
Okay, cool.
Because he didn't do that with Kevorkian. He didn't do that with Phil Spector. He had an opportunity to, and he didn't. His number four, this blogger, his number four is Carlito Bragante. Go ahead, Jerry.
No, I think that should definitely be on there. That's definitely one of the, I mean, that is like, you know, that's a very underrated movie. And it definitely deserves to be on there. It's a great performance of him, but it is really the real star of the movie is Sean Penn. I mean, that's the real, I think, revelation there, Sean Penn's performance.
Penn kind of steals the movie away.
Yeah.
A little bit.
I've never particularly been impressed with that performance in Carlito's Way. It's fine. Well, the thing that does impress me most about his performance in that movie, which wasn't necessarily exceedingly well received when it came out.
No,
it's really grown in stature over the years. But I think once people saw, oh, it's not as kind of thrilling or bombastic as Scarface, I think it disappointed them at first, and then they appreciated it for what it was. I've never been necessarily crazy about the movie because I think it's that story itself is so worn out of the hood that wants to go good, but the forces pull them back down.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I do find special about it is the direction of the action sequences because of De Palma, the staging of those, and Pacino as an action star, and how much he does with his eyes. I mean, if you look at the pool table scene, that movie is completely choreographed with his eyes. I mean, you feel the threat and exactly where it's coming from because of Pacino's gaze. His, like, alertness in that chase scene at Grand Central Station.
Right.
And you know, just a great, great action performance in that. Mm-hmm. Tony Montana is this guy's number three. I mean, you know, talk about an iconic performance.
Yeah.
I mean,
what are you going to say? It has to be there. It has to be in the top 10, that's for sure.
I mean, it's difficult to find many others in the past 30 years that compare in terms of their reach and influence.
Yeah, I mean, in Spring Breakers, it's referenced. I mean, James Franco's character, Alien, he says on a continual loop, that movie.
Number two, Ricky Roma and Glenn Ross.
It's one supporting performance in the list.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty high up.
Yeah,
Ricky Roma.
I'm surprised. Yeah.
But, you know, got to give him credit for, you know, creativity in some ways. But,
it's
but
a good performance.
I
remember walking out of that movie and wanting to be Ricky Roma. I mean, he had such a swagger in that movie. That was great. And who else do you want to deliver those kinds of monologues?
Right.
They're number one.
I love it in that movie, by the way, when he says, I forgot who he says it to, but he calls them, you fucking child.
Remember
that line in that film? Oh, God, I love that. That stuck in my head. That's a great thing to call somebody.
You never open your mouth till you know what the score is, you fucking child. Great.
Great.
Their number one is actually my number two, right behind Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah.
And it's Michael Corleone in The Godfather 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's, I would love them both together because, you know, I'm interested to see those movies with Al Pacino where he's displaying a certain sort of gentility, and that's what's interesting about the beginning of Godfather is that he's got a little bit of that in those first scenes in the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, by the second movie, he's just completely closed off and and it's got them that world. I mean, obviously, that has to be number one.
Yeah, I mean, it's the most important character, I think, in American cinema and American fiction. I mean, Michael Corleone is just the... I mean, there is no... I don't know if there is any more important American character than that.
I don't know. It's such a fascinating circumstance that he found himself in to be able to continue a character over the course of 16 years or whatever it was at different stages of his life. And I find that of those three, the most fascinating portrait is the second one. And I think Pauline Kael put it that he does the impossible. He gives like an immobile performance. His eyes are black. He's soulless. He's lost his soul. And for it just gives you a sense of the power of a movie star, because he does nothing throughout a lot of it, and a lot of it is delivered very monotone, very dead, and yet he's totally magnetic. I mean, there's no doubt he is in charge. He is someone to be feared. This guy that probably stands 5'6", I think it's just such a brilliant, beautifully expressive in its inexpressiveness. impossible to do. I mean, that really is an impossible performance.
You know, some other performances that didn't appear on this list, I wanted to mention. You know, there's a few that I really love. You know, his first main role in Panic in Needle Park. I think he's really wonderful in that, opposite Kitty Wynn. Of course, opposite Gene Hackman in Scarecrow.
Yeah,
another beautiful, gentle performance.
Probably the Scarecrow and Frankie and Johnny are the two sweetest performances he's ever given.
I agree. I was going to mention Frankie and Johnny, too, which is a movie that, you know, you can forget that he was in, but boy, that was a wonderful, wonderful adaptation of that play. And and so amazing, too, that, you know, he's playing opposite Michelle Pfeiffer, and they're both nominally playing, you know, two losers that haven't found love. And, you know, and on stage, these characters were played by people who were a lot more frumpy than these two actors. But yet, both of them completely and utterly convince the viewer that they are indeed people who have lost out in the search for romance and
Michelle Pfeiffer has a standout role in that, because first of all, Michelle Pfeiffer is absolutely stunning. She's one of the most beautiful women ever for me. So this was a real departure for her. And if you remember when she got cast, it was a bit controversial because on the stage, I think Kathy Bates originated that role. So Michelle Pfeiffer is very special in the movie. But it is a love story because of Pacino. Because when you see Pacino look at her, you know he's in love.
Right.
I think the whole love and romance of it comes from him.
And he has a lot of the film's laughs too, which is something also unusual in his career. But I wanted to posit one film that I would have definitely made a place on here. Now I know that your choice might be his role, your choice, Jamie or Jerry, might be his role in Heat, and I do love him in that movie. But I like him as Lowell Bergman in The Insider.
I would have thought would be on this list. I mean,
I think that's an incredibly subtle performance from him in that film.
I adore him in The Insider. I enjoy the Insider performance a lot more than Heat. It took me a long time to appreciate him in Heat. I didn't like him at first. And I do still think, as much as I appreciate Pacino in Heat, I do think that it's still De Niro's movie in terms of performance.
I
think that The Insider, it is so incredibly subtle, but it's so entirely lived in. That's why it's easy to miss him in that movie.
Uh-huh.
But you totally believe him as Lowell Bergman, as the newsman.
Yeah, right.
Another standout performance for me in a movie that isn't a standout is People I Know. One of his most inventive performances is People I Know, actually. And any Pacino freak that hasn't seen that, check that out. I mean, he plays this idealistic 60s Southern guy in entertainment, you know, that's kind of fallen way hard from his glory days during the civil rights movement and all that kind of stuff. And just as a man, as a man in a desperate state in the last 24 hours of his life, he's so good in that movie. He really is. And it's a genuine performance that you haven't seen before from him. But
what
there's also his, stuff like. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I have to mention this too because I haven't seen it in a long time, and so it's difficult. He was nominated for an Oscar for this back in '79, but I remember watching it on cable in the '80s and just really enjoying his performance in Injustice for All.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely.
He's really, really energetic in that film, and yes, the film has some script problems and so forth, but it's really, of course, Pacino that really carries the movie, and it has a terrific supporting cast too. But it's the acting that carries that film, and particularly Pacino. So,
Pacino makes another iconic. You know, he makes the end of that movie iconic.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
With his You're Out of Order.
Yeah, the whole You're Out of Order. The whole court's out of order. Yeah, that's great.
There's subtle, if you want to see subtle Pacino work, outside of, I mean, Donnie Brasco is, oh my God, Donnie Brasco is amazing. But
he's also so wonderful in that.
he is so good. He's like the Willie Loman of mobsters. He's so good in that movie.
Oh, God, but, he makes you weep. He's so good.
Yeah. There's also his performance in City Hall, which missteps in the funeral scene where it gets a bit too bombastic, but that's just the take that they chose. But the rest of the movie is an incredibly underplayed, subtle performance. It really is. And it's a guy that's kind of haunted by his implication in the murder of a child. And you see it in his face. And there are scenes that he has, long dialogue scenes. That movie's entirely dialogue with John Cusack that play really nicely. He's well matched with Cusack. He's well matched with Johnny Depp. But then again, I also like the bombastic Pacino when he's playful. And anybody that complained about his performance in Devil's Advocate, how else do you want the devil played?
This is
a devil that enjoys being the devil, you know?
Right.
Nobody says, you know, part of the fun of watching Nicholson play the devil was seeing him, like, lick his lips and, you know, delight on playing the devil.
It's true. I mean, you
Not everything has to be entirely subtle and naturalistic to be worthy.
Yeah, I mean, he got nominated for an Oscar, too, for playing, you know, Big Boy Caprice and Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that is a real fun performance. That's another movie that I need to go back and revisit, I remember enjoying that movie immensely.
Yeah. So all good stuff. Jerry, if you were to pick one, your favorite, what would it be?
Oh, the Godfather trilogy, without a doubt.
Do you think the third portrayal of Michael Corleone was worthy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have no... I said it when it came out, and I'll say it now. I have no regrets about liking that movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
we go back and take a look at it again, you know, the further away we get from 1990 and everything, the better the movie looks, I think.
I mean, it's that obvious that, you know, in all three movies, that Coppola really identifies with Michael Corleone. He really identifies with him.
Well, and I think just in terms of the way he performs that character, I like the way he performed that character. And I missed another one of his great... I mean, Merchant of Venice, he gives a great performance in that film.
Yeah, he is good.
He is truly great in that movie. But there's another one, Insomnia. The perfect blending between the emotional and the physical. I mean, in terms of a physical performance, the various degrees of sleep deprivation that occur with that character. He's incredibly strong in that movie, I think.
Yeah.
No, that's a good movie. A very underrated movie.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're even forgetting, you know, something he won an Emmy for, playing Ray Warcone
and
Angels in America.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another massive, huge, very difficult performance.
I like that performance fine. There's one piece of direction that I hate is that, and I don't know how you avoid it, where he has pains in the movie from his disease, from AIDS, and the pains always come on conveniently right after he recites a line, and it happens like all the way through the movie, and that just bugged me. There are some performances of Pacino's, even though I worship at the altar of Pacino. You know, I'm like Benicio del Toro. They asked Benicio del Toro about who his favorite actor is. No, it was Javier Bardem. And he said, you know, I don't believe in God, but I do believe in Al Pacino. And I kind of feel the same way.
Yeah.
So I idolize the man. But there's some performances I can't gel with, that I think are definite weaker efforts. But, you know, when you do 50 movies or however many it is in his career, you know, there's bound to be some that don't click.
Right.
It's inevitable.
Yeah. All right, so we'll be back next week with God Knows Who, but we will have a Lynch series episode coming up Wednesday night with the co-star of Mulholland Drive, Laura Herring. So look forward to that. We booked Glenn Gordon Caron for Clean and Sober, and some other guests will be forthcoming, I'm sure. We covered the 80s and then 90s, but
yes.
We haven't done the 70s yet, right?
Yeah, so
have we not done the 70s? That's craziness.
We'll do the 70s.
Yes.
Okay, so let's plan on the 70s sometime in April.
Okay, sounds good. All right.
Okay. All right, guys.
All right.
All right. Good night, everyone.
We close with a piece of music.
Make it a good one. Hey, make it a Phil Spector song.
Okay, let's play Phil Spector. All right, guys. Good night.
All right, good night.
See you later.
All right, bye.